Sea Change, a podcast dedicated to telling the amazing stories of amazing women who are unafraid to disrupt the status quo and make a difference. I'm Annie Silas, your host and CEO of R. Silas & Company, a women-owned financial services firm that is dedicated to creating more opportunity for women in our industry and in the community. My guest today is Laura Bray, the founder of an incredible nonprofit called Angels for Change that is working tirelessly to end the crisis of drug shortages in this country. This is a problem so many of us don't even know exists until we come face to face with it. Laura is an inspirational example of a woman who was faced with a crisis and took action and is now leaving the landscape of the drug industry changed. It is no coincidence that her title at Angels for Change is Chief Changemaker. So without further ado, Laura, welcome and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Annie.
We're so excited. Chief Changemaker, that's a great title. So thanks. Tell us, before we get started with anything else, what is Angels for Change?
Sure. Angels for Change is a nonprofit founded under the mission to end drug shortages through advocacy, awareness, and a resilient supply chain. Our purpose is really focused on access to healthcare, ensuring access to life-saving drugs. And the first problem we're tackling is the systemic health crisis, which is a drug shortage.
So for those of us that are unfamiliar with the problem, and I certainly was one of those before we met, what exactly is a drug shortage?
So there's a lot of different definitions. The FDA's definition is very simple, and it's when there's not enough supply to meet the demand of an essential life-saving medicine in the marketplace. Angels for Change defines it a smidge differently. It's patient-focused, and it's if there is not enough supply to meet demand, and any patient protocol is being changed because of supply, there is a drug shortage. Systemically and historically in the healthcare space, when there hasn't been enough supply, one of the main mitigation factors is to change patient protocols to meet the supply. So basically to change demand to meet supply instead of changing supply to meet demand. Sometimes those are temporary shifts, but sometimes they become very long-term changes. And we really wanna, flip the switch on that and say, if a patient is being impacted by business decisions, supply-based decisions, that's a drug shortage.
I think that's key. I think, so just put very, very simply for our listeners, these drugs exist. It's just that they can't get to the patient.
Yeah, we're talking about, medicines that are proven protocols, gone through all the, this is not research-based. This is about making sure that patients have access to the medicines that are available today. I like to say, Angels for Change, we're fixing the pharmaceutical supply chain for today's therapies and tomorrow's cures. So while a lot of nonprofits focus on research and the next thing to help patients, I say, we need to fix the supply chain so that patients have access to the medicines that were developed 75 years ago and 5 years ago and yesterday, as well as the ones that are going to be developed 75 years from now.
Right. So let's take a step back. Laura, this problem first came to your attention when your own family was dealing with a pediatric cancer diagnosis. And so I assume you didn't even know that it existed until you were faced with it.
No, I did not know this existed. I teach business and supply chain and economics. And when we first found out that our child's treatment protocol was going to be impacted by a drug shortage, I had a lot of questions. Wait, why isn't scarcity fixing this? Come again. What are the mitigation strategies? Is this a quality assurance event? I went right into business mode. But, I think the journey of starting Angels for Change and learning about drug shortages really started 4.5 months before our first drug shortage. And that was, when we got put on this journey of being a pediatric cancer family. And, I didn't know much about pediatric cancer either. right? So I guess really our story begins Thanksgiving weekend of 2018. We were sitting around in our jammies watching the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, probably like many of your listeners were that day. And our cell phone rang, and it was my children's pediatrician. And it was really just 30 seconds of words that changed our lives and made us a new family. And those words were, "There are blasts in Abby's blood. There's a bed waiting for her at St. Joe's Oncology Unit. Pack a bag, plan to stay. You've got to get there now." And it was those words where we learned that our middle child, who was 9 at the time, had cancer. And we were ill-prepared for those words. And, you know, I think you do what every parent does at that moment. You just travel the path that was set in front of you as a parent, right? You don't really, there's a lot of choices you don't get as a parent, and you just travel that path. And there was a lot of questions we had, and we began navigating that and all the terrible, you know, questions and pediatric cancer, it's not just a single patient diagnosis, it's really a family diagnosis, right? So my child who is going through treatment has a lot of questions, terrible questions you never thought you were going to answer. And my other children have terrible questions that you don't know how to answer, you never thought you were going to answer. And some of them were easier than others, like, you know, what, you know, can I go back to school? You know, like that you just follow, you know, well, this is what the doctor's going to say, you know, what about my hair? You know, all the things, you know, and all the new things, like learning about anticipatory sickness, which actually means that the anticipation of what's about to happen makes your child physically ill. And so you just have to help them, you know, when walking into the hospital before they get their chemotherapy is part of them getting sick. You just have to help them through it. And what helped us through was this protocol that we were given on the very first day when we entered that hospital. And it was very long and arduous and, you know, not anything you'd wish on anybody, but there was assurances in that protocol. And we just kind of, when Abby asked that, the really tough question, which is, you know, what's going to happen? Am I going to die? And we just said, you know, we're going to do what the doctor says, and it's going to be okay. Right. So,
and Laura, let me stop you for 1 second. The protocol that you're speaking of, that's really the treatment protocol, kind of step by step, how we're going to attack this, what our game plan is.
All the medicines, all the timing of those medicines coming together to move this diagnosis, which was once 100%, you know, fatal to what she had, ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So now it's 90%. Success.
Right.
And there's actually the cure word in this pediatric cancer. And so, but it is dependent upon a very long, very detailed and hard protocol with a lot of mixes of medicines.
So that's kind of like your battle plan. And for every parent, for every patient who's facing this crisis, that's a little bit like your security blanket at the beginning saying, this is terrible, but we have a plan.
Absolutely. And that's what we called it too. It was like our parachute. We passed that parachute on to our child, and she knows how important it is, right?
Right.
When she doesn't want to take this medicine anymore, we're using every tool in our toolkit to do it. So are the doctors, and so are the nurses. And there's entire child life specialists in a pediatric hospital designed to help a child through taking these. So they're acutely aware of this roadmap, and they're acutely aware of how important it is for them to follow this step by step.
Okay, so you get to the hospital, you start fighting this fight. And what's that first moment that this gets brought to your attention, that one of these drugs that's so critical to this protocol is not available?
Yeah, so it was about 4.5 months in. And we started a new phase, and this phase had a very important medicine. In fact, it's one of the only medicines that is targeted to leukemic cancer cells in the protocol. And we went in to take it, and we were told, you're not going to have it today. It's on shortage. And so that was April of 2019. So, you know, fast forward from, you know, the end of November to the very, it was actually the first beginning of April. And, you know, again, I had a lot of questions, but this time I was a little bit more familiar with the questions to ask and the language of supply chain. And I just said, wait, you know, what do you mean it's on shore? You know, is this, you know, what are the mitigation strategies? You know, what is the time frame for it to be, you know, back on in supply? You know, and I knew a couple of things. Just because one supply chain member doesn't have access to a product in the supply chain doesn't mean that it's an outage. And just because it's an outage doesn't mean that, you know, there aren't answers. There's usually some sort of mitigation. And that there are many members in any supply chain, especially a global supply chain or one of the largest global supply chains in the world, which is healthcare. So I had those, that base knowledge, and I just used that knowledge with basic Google searches and 800 numbers, and began to search for the medicines that she would need.
The doctor tells you that this drug's not available. And I mean, here you are, you're fighting for your kid's life. And all of a sudden, one of these drugs is out of reach and you just go into mom mode, right? I'm going to find it.
Yeah. In fact, it was funny. The doctor, you know, I was like, okay, so let me ask one question, you know, is this medicine life-saving and essential? Is this necessary? Yes. Okay. Be ready to say that when they call.
I love that.
And she said, when who calls? And I said, well, I don't know yet, but just be ready to say that. You know, I just found out this existed. But, you know, Abby was there with me in the room when we get delivered this information. And so that was the second moment, and actually probably the harder moment of that those terrible questions, right? Remember, the first ones were terrible questions, but, you know, there was a lot written about it for me to find, and there was a knowledge base to, you know, like lean into. And there was also a lot of nonprofits there and support groups, right, for that initial diagnosis. And there was the protocol as a parachute.
Right.
So now here we are, our protocol parachute's been taken away. And Abby does say, you know, what happens now?
And what did you find to be the problem with this particular drug? How did you find it?
So so for this particular drug, it was at the base, two big issues that kind of happens a lot in the drug shortages. One, there was a single source provider. So when there's only one person manufacturing and providing a life-saving essential medicine, there, you know, if think about any product, there could be very big problems if something happens at that one manufacturer. And then the second thing is that this manufacturer had multiple QA quality assurance events over the years, and there just was no safety stock available. So, but for this, how did I find it? Not by myself. I basically armed, you know, all of our friends and family, and we made calls, and we did what was ever necessary to get Abby, our patient one, you know, our only patient, back on protocol. And we did, we found it, you know, by calling hospitals to hospitals everywhere in the US and saying, would you be willing to, do you have any extra? And would you be willing to share? We call that now at Angels for Change, we call that rebalancing. So sometimes we still have to do that. We call and say, you know, hey, we've got a patient at this hospital who needs help, just kind of rebalancing the system a little bit so that the right drug's in the right place at the right time.
So at what point did you realize that this wasn't just a problem with this drug and your daughter, but that this was a real kind of systemic crisis? and kind of start to understand the scope of the problem.
Even after Abby, like, so zero focus, the first 10 days was getting Abby back on protocol. But afterwards I had a lot of questions. Why did this happen? How did this happen? Is it a one-off event? No, I mean, this one specific drug had been on and off shortage for 5 years. And then there's all kinds of data. I mean, the more I look, there was more and more information. I mean, the FDA calls this marketplace a broken marketplace. You know, drug shortages are persistent and systemic all throughout the supply chain. And, you know, there are hundreds of drug shortages every year that are essential medicines. So what I would say is Abby's initial success was wonderful. We got her back on protocol. I was just very haunted knowing, like, why did this happen? How did this happen? How could it happen? Why isn't scarcity working here? Why isn't the theory of supply and demand working here? All those questions. But also really what drove me is knowing Abby's shortage was fixed.
Right.
Meaning she had her medicine, but this shortage was not fixed.
Right.
And it was persistent. And there were parents all over the US hearing the same thing I heard, getting the same question that their children asked, which Abby was like, you know, what happens now? Will I die if I don't get this? And how do you sleep at night knowing that's a question your child had to contemplate? How do you sleep at night knowing that that is a question that parents all over are having to answer? So
right.
That was what I decided to start Angels for Change. It wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to just help Abby. I wanted this to not happen to anyone else.
I was going to say, because I feel like, Laura, there's so many moms out there who are thinking, God, you know, she's got a kid with cancer. She's got two other kids. She's got a full-time job. And she decides to tackle this entire problem. But I think you said it right there. You just couldn't rest knowing that this was out there and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that it was fixable. Is that fair?
So I didn't know at first if it was fixable. I knew one single truth. What happened to my child should not happen to anyone. And, you know, the reason why I named my, you know, Angels for Change and Chief Changemaker was, okay, that's one truth that I can hold on to. One truth. It is a right to have access. We need to ensure access to these life-saving drugs. We're not talking about new drugs. We're not talking about, you know, unproven drugs. We're talking about the salt and pepper of any pharmacy and, you know, like the things that keep a pharmacy running and the back of our entire modern healthcare system. We need to ensure that, and that shouldn't happen. And so I said, well, you know, I don't know everything about this supply chain. I know nothing about science. I know nothing about really medicine, but I know this one fact. And I always tell my students, you know, find your purpose, then like do it on purpose and be very stingy about that purpose, but very flexible about how you get there. So plans can change, they can be iterative, you can be building as you go. All of that is true, and the roadmap can change over and over again. But you've got to have that single purpose, that mission, that purpose, and don't deviate. And so I said, well, I knew that this was true and real and would always be true and real for me. This shouldn't happen. What happened to us shouldn't happen. So I just said, I've got to figure out how to make change, right? Like, I don't know what I can do at first, but I know it shouldn't happen. And I know I can incrementally take steps forward. I can make a website, and anybody who's having the problem can call me and I'll share the knowledge that I did, you know, what I did, and we'll walk hand in hand so that they're not alone like I'm alone. Well, every time I did that, I met new people in the supply chain and that grew and expanded. So I would say our first mission was really just driving change in this crisis. But about a year and a half, so a year ago, we'd been in it for a year and a half. No, that doesn't sound like long, but I had learned so much. in that year and a half navigating the supply chain in a way that, you know, hadn't been done before. And we were the only nonprofit focused on ending drug shortages, which is part of the precipitous. Originally, I just thought I was going to share my story with whoever was fixing this and help them, but
you found there was no one out there doing it.
There was no one else.
So was this literally a problem that doctors and patients were just living with, sort of accepting that this was something that existed?
So I would say for two decades or more, it's really been held on the backs of the hospital pharmacists.
Okay.
They have been navigating this Herculean efforts, navigating a drug shortage. You know, that most hospital pharmacists say they're navigating a drug shortage every day.
Wow.
So it is, you know, persistent. You know, 8.6 million hospital hours in the United States are dedicated to drug shortages every year.
And are they all within pediatric cancer?
No, that's a good question. No, no, they're not. They're with our essential, you know, medicines. But pediatric cancer is uniquely vulnerable to drug shortages. We did a white paper in September of last year with Vizient and US Pharmacopeia that showed a couple of things. Pediatric cancer really relies on very difficult to make, very inexpensive generic chemotherapies, which makes them uniquely vulnerable to shortage, which is why my daughter didn't just hit that first one. She actually hit three. There were three life-saving medicines in her parachute that led to her having shortages and protocol time, you know, time changes. And that was just in 9 months of treatment, because pediatric cancer relies on some of these medicines that are older. So our white paper proved that pediatric cancer medicines are 90% more likely to go in shortage than the average essential medicine. And when they're in shortage, they stay short over 30% longer.
Wow.
So they're going in more often, and they're harder and more complicated to fix, means they're not resilient whatsoever.
So that's actually a great segue into my question, which is, so Angels for Change, you start out just thinking, I'm going to share this information, I'm going to be a resource for other families. And it's evolved into an organization that is actually trying to put in a long-term solve and create that resilient supply chain. How do you do that? What exactly are you guys doing to fix this problem?
Great question. So when somebody is supplying a life-saving medicine, we really need to say, how are you ready? How are you ready to supply these patients? Not how are you going to mitigate it if you don't supply? Not what are you going to do when you fail to supply? We got to have these programs in place that makes you ready to supply, which is a resilient supply chain. It's redundancy. It's looking at the complete transparency of the supply chain. I was shocked. One of the shocks that I had was that there really is a deep fragmentation of this supply chain compared to any other supply chain that I had knowledge with. And it's actually by design. It's called limited visibility by design. There's so many regulations that are necessary for medicines, right? That keep you not, if you're a manufacturer, you not knowing who actually has it. There's HIPAA. I mean, all the things around medicines and patient privacy. And hey, here's what we're going to do to end drug shortages. We're going to look at three things. One is transparency. We got to see the entire supply chain to really know the root problem. That's where any strategy from any business starts, right? You know, the second is we're going to build in redundancies. And the third is we're going to do it as a complete system of health, right? Looking at the patient as the center, as the consumer, not as the individual members. And so that's, you know, our goal. And how are we doing that? Well, the system of health, we started our Summit One, which is a summit for the entire health system, the entire health supply chain, coming together solely focused on drug shortages and ending them as a complete system. So we've had three of them. We've hosted three. Our fourth one is at the end of the month. It's hosted at McKesson. So we're the nonprofit being the catalyst to bring everybody together, but we really want to encourage the supply chain members to be the drivers of this change. And we will support that. That's connecting the whole supply chain. The other is transparency. We've been doing this through Summit, everybody talking together, but also through research. And the big one though, redundancy, resilient. How do we build that? And we found one way that we think can actually build a redundant and resilient supply chain for a large handful of these drugs that are persistently low cost and, have some of the quality assurance issues, not enough suppliers in the marketplace. And we entered the granting space and we went to smaller manufacturers and said, what would it look like for you to enter the marketplace? What would be the barriers to enter the marketplace for a drug that's on shortage? And what would those barriers be? And we're looking to not just increase supply, we're looking to increase capacity. Capacity is one of the keys. A lot of the solutions have been going back to the manufacturers who already manufacture these drugs and asking or incentivizing them to increase supply. But that's not redundant. That's not resilient. And so this is a new manufacturer who would increase capacity and increase supply. And they're onshore. So a smaller onshore flexible manufacturer of pharmaceuticals. What would it look like? Why aren't they doing this? They're not doing it because there's a lot of barriers to enter and they can only produce when it's short because that's the only time they would have the legal ability to do that. And when they produce it, they're not going to have the economies of scale. The price point is going to be higher. So there's a lot of risk in taking that opportunity on, which is why the theory of scarcity isn't working.
Right. I think that that's really key. I think that people listening might not appreciate that as I didn't when I was first hearing about this, that when something's on short, you sort of naturally think, why wouldn't someone jump in and start making it? And wouldn't that make economic sense for them? But this industry has specific reasons why someone wouldn't do that. And they're valid for these businesses.
Right. And no one woke up. That's one thing that I learned really quickly in the beginning, even when I founded Angels for Change. No one woke up one day and said, I don't want Abby Bray to have her life-saving medicine, right? No one was doing something actively to us, yet it still happened. It happened to us and it was tragic and it was a healthcare crisis. And when that happens, it's a systemic issue. So you've got to bring change to the plate. If you don't do anything, it's going to stay the same. So you've got to bring change. So our pilot looked at what would that look like? What would the cost be? What would those barriers to enter the marketplace? And you got a radical transparency, right? One of our three focuses is transparency. You got to show us radical transparency. We got to connect more than one player. It's not just going to be a player, Angels for Change and another organization. We've got to bring as many people into the party as possible to talk about it and then show us what that would be. And we'll grant you a majority of those barriers.
So is that a financial grant to overcome those barriers?
It was. It's a financial grant.
What would be an example? So say they said, the biggest barrier is that, this is only short, 3 months a year, and I need to be, manufacturing at 12. What does that look like for you? Do you financially compensate them for those other 9 months?
No, I say, what does it look like to enter this marketplace? We're going to pay a majority of those. And you're then going to promise to be a redundant player of capacity and supply for the next 3 years.
How many of those grants have you done?
Well, so we just did one. So we've done, that was a proof of concept. It's gone swimmingly. It's gone very well. So the if it doesn't go short, we still find value in that. That is a more resilient supply chain, and you can reapply for this grant again 3 years later, right? You've made these supply contracts, they cost money, you didn't use the supply. You can reapply, or you can say, you know, that really wasn't worth it for us, and we go and find someone else to do it. That's fine. But if it goes short, you're committing to be ready to enter the marketplace in whatever capacity you said that you could add, and you're opening it up. So for this pilot, we connected with Children's Hospital Association, because how do we know how much is the right amount of capacity? How do we test this? How do we see, looking at this like a pilot that could, you know, so that we could scale it and replicate it. And we partnered with a manufacturer, Stack Pharma, who was founded specifically around increased access. So the A in Stack is access. The T is transparency. They had a very close relationship with children's hospitals. And so it kind of was a really good fit to start. And that pilot, we launched in April, and in the first 8 weeks, it increased the capacity 25,000 units. Each unit could help 7.5 to 8 children. Of the 25,000 units, 20,000 actually had to be used.
Wow.
Which equated to 110,000 life-saving pediatric treatments in 8 weeks.
That's amazing.
And yeah, I kept saying, hey, if we help one patient, it was worth it.
Right.
If we made a redundant supply chain on the ready within 40, you know, that could enter the marketplace very quickly in 42 days, and we helped one patient, mission, Angels for Change hit their mission. We ended a drug shortage. We made a more resilient supply chain. It was, you know, we advocated on behalf of patients, but.
So where do you get the funding to make the grants?
So we had a gala, our first gala.
We are
not quite 3 years old. We're 2.5 years old. So we had our first gala last fall, and we raised $85,000 at that gala. I had some other, you know, sponsors or partners who had, you know, sometimes it was patients who we helped who then did a fundraiser for us that we didn't even know. And I was like, well, I'll round that up to $100,000. I have $100,000. Let's see this thing that I've been talking about. Let's see if we can make it work. Now, when I say I wasn't actually the originator of this idea. There have been ideas like this for years. In fact, I found it from a NIH report. National Institute of Health did a report on outsourcing facilities and their place in the marketplace and how they could end drug shortages. And I was like very interested in what was in this, you know, paper that was submitted by NHS, but just no one had done it. And again, no one was singularly focused on ending drug shortages.
So, and do these smaller manufacturers find you, or did you go out and find them as potential recipients of the grant?
So this one as a pilot was really Children's Hospital Association was the catalyst of it. And
but now that you have this proof of concept, the idea would be to kind of take that list of short drugs, right? And just kind of one by one find these types of solutions through this grant program?
Well, we're hoping 10 by 10.
10 by 10, I love it.
10 at a time.
Even better.
So we're going to look at drugs vulnerable to shortage. We're partnering with U.S. Pharmacopeia. They have a medicine supply map that they have developed that has an algorithm, and partnering with them to show us the vulnerability. We're going to look at patient impact, just because a drug is more vulnerable. We're talking about life-saving essential, nothing else that someone can do that, you know, patient impact prioritization, feasibility, some of these drugs will not be able to be done in this way. Some are so complex, they can't be done, you know, onshore, or they can't be done in a small batch way. And then of course, resource allocation,
right?
As much resource as I have to allocate toward it, as many as I'll do. But the goal that I set is 10 in the next 12 months, in the sense that, you know, what's haunting me now is what would have happened in May if I hadn't said, let's give it a try, right? I have $100,000 of risk. I was the first money that we actually had, and I, you know, moved it towards this. But I'm up at night now saying, what if I hadn't done that? What if I had been risk averse to that and said, you know, we've got to find grant money first. We've got to find somebody to fund it before I can do it. What would have happened to those patients? 110,000 treatments. Well, you know, I don't want to even think about the amount of work that would have happened at a hospital because of that, the amount of, right, you know, patient protocols being changed. What would have happened?
Well, I think that's what this has brought to my attention, is that it is an everyone problem, because you never know when you're going to get faced with a health crisis or your child's going to get faced with a health crisis, and this could be you, but also the resources in the system, the time that doctors and hospitals are spending that could be spent on cures, on other treatments, on taking care of their patients. I think we're all stakeholders in this solution.
And this solution did not cost $50 million. It didn't cost $500 million, right? It's onshore, it's flexible. The company that we partnered with, Stack, they have a true and real business case to move this forward. And they won't need another grant from us. They now are there. They are interested. You know, this has been a good, you know, corporate social responsibility project at its heart, but it's also been extremely beneficial to them.
Right.
And I went to visit the facility, and, you know, one of the employees, the employee who puts the label on the syringe before it goes into the box to be shipped, said to me, "This is the most fulfilling work I've ever done. I know every label I put on, I just helped 7.5 children."
That's amazing.
And, you know, that is the benefit. It's flexible. It's like a little bit of an ignition into the marketplace. FDA says the marketplace is broken. We don't need to scrap the marketplace, because in actuality, 99% of medicines get to the right place at the right time.
Right.
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 It's that 1% that is traumatic and very impactful. We've got to put the right ignition into the marketplace for that 1%. And so I'm very proud of it. I can't wait to duplicate it.
It's amazing.
Over and over again.
Now, Laura, what would your advice be to other women out there who see problems out there? They've maybe faced these problems. They know what the solution is, but might find the idea of doing something kind of overwhelming. They might look at you and say, like, with your background, of course you know what to do. I don't have that background. You know, I'm not sure I can tackle this. What was that sort of putting one foot in front of the other moment for you and just trying to figure this out?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's in the trying that extraordinary things happen. And you don't have to solve the entire thing today. What is one thing that you can do today and then build from there? You know, like I said, find your purpose, do it on purpose. Well, if this is your purpose, right?
Yeah.
What's the one thing you're going to do
yeah.
for that purpose today? And, you know, and then, you know, I also tell my kids this, like, we don't make decisions based on fear, right? And a lot of times that, like, nervous energy, that nervous-sided, like, that might be where real life begins. Like, when you're not really sure, you don't know what the next thing is, that, like, nervous-sided, like, if you can harness that and help you move forward towards your goal, instead of making it move backwards, that I think that is key to just about everything.
Right? I couldn't agree more. I think that's so well put.
I think if you think about life, the moments that you look back on are those nervous, excited, those nervous-sighted moments, right? And then I just say, you don't have to solve everything, right?
Yeah.
One step at a time. What can you do?
And you started with your own group of friends, right? Saying, hey, I need to do this and I need your help.
Yeah. My friends, they rue the day I invited them to dinner. But yes. So my friends, I invited them to dinner and, they were all part of my network who helped Abby. Right. They all leaned in, right? They leaned in to help us when she was diagnosed. They leaned in to help my other children. Like that was, that's one thing I'll say. If you have someone whose family is going through a health crisis, you don't know what to do for them, do something for their kids if it's a mom, because that right there just takes some of that pressure off. But that's my little PSA in the middle of this. But so I invited them over. And we had a dinner and I was, I've been doing research. Did you know this, that the FDA says it's a broken market? It is systemic. It didn't, this has been going on for 20 years, all those things. And they're like, oh my gosh. Yeah. As shocked as I was, and as hopefully your listeners were when they said, oh my gosh, I didn't really realize this was a systemic issue. I said, so I think I'm going to do this. I'm going to start a nonprofit. And I'm going to try to be the change I want to see in the world. And they were like, this is wonderful. We support you. And then I said, okay, great. I'm so glad you support me. Now I need you to be my director of people. And I need you to be my director of operations. And I need you to be the director of marketing.
And then
they were all like, thankfully, they are wonderful, amazing, talented, experienced mothers. And they said yes. But
I think that's really important. All of that that you just said, I think, not having to solve the whole problem at once, just start with your friends and family, just hang on to that one truth and take it one step at a time.
And then the last thing is something we say every day at Angels for Change. If it's the right path, it'll be easy. Doesn't mean that it's not work, but it will lay itself out for you,
right,
and it will fall in line with a lot of work. But if you are banging your head, especially at a problem like this, there's so many places that could benefit from support because it's a systemic issue. If I target one and it's just not working, the cost benefit analysis of forcing this is not there. I'm going to focus on the culture of the willing, who's with me today, who wants to make change with me today, and really be excited about that progress.
I think that's amazing. I think we're so lucky that you had the guts to be a change maker and take this on. I'm sure that there are so many families who are so grateful that you did. I am grateful that you brought it to our attention, because I think it's frightening, actually, that so many of us don't know that this is something that exists out there. Before we let you go, we want to know how Abby's doing. I'm sure there's many other parts of her story besides being a cancer patient. So will you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for asking. And I'm sorry if I let anybody on the seat of their pants worried.
I know we should have spoken about it up front.
At the beginning. I'm sorry. So yeah, she's doing fantastic. She is 16 months cancer and chemo free.
Amazing.
We were in COVID isolation for 16 months. For 16 months, we could not go anywhere but the hospital as the entire family. So she is enjoying life as a 12-year-old. And I feel very blessed that she didn't just survive, but she's able to have the opportunity to thrive. And it is not lost on us that not everybody has that end story. So she's doing great.
It's inspirational. Laura, what do you want our listeners take away to be on what we can all do to support Angels for Change and help put an end to drug shortages?
Well, you know, I'm chief change maker. I'll use any change makers out there who want to help us end drug shortages. The easiest way is sharing our story or following us. You can donate if you'd like to sponsor. I would love some more sponsors. The amount of money we have means more drugs that we can make more resilient so that no patient is impacted by a shortage.
That's fantastic. And we'll absolutely share your website and contact info with all of our listeners. Thank you for all that you're doing. Thank you for being with us today and sharing all of it with us. And I look forward to the day when you've solved this problem and drug shortages are no longer an issue.
I do too.